This is the Friday, February 17th, 2017 version of the Market Plus segment. Joining us now is Elaine Kupp. Elaine, welcome back.
Delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. This is always a great discussion when you're on. We look at things from a 10,000-foot view or a 50,000-foot view.
I can't deal with details, yeah.
Perfect. Well, details, kind of, are interesting at times. We've seen the cotton market put on a heck of a rally.
Yep.
Really looking to buy acres was
sure.
a thought. Now we step back this week. Talk to us about cotton, and more specifically, how did cotton close on Friday? What did that look like?
It really, really collapsed on Friday. And I guess I don't know exactly the final price that it closed down on, but I think that was another one of these markets, alongside a lot of commodity markets, that just received a lot of profit-taking, I think, here right at the end. There was not a lot of justification for, I mean, I guess if we can go back whenever the latest WASDE report came out that they trimmed their stocks-to-use ratio. So now the global stocks-to-use ratio is only 80%.
Wow.
I mean, so that's not really bullish.
But of that 80%, how much is China's stockpile where quality and condition is truly unknown?
That's a really good point, is when you go down to individual, the spreads between certain quality factors, that there might be certainly opportunities for U.S. merchandisers, but we're not going to see that specifically played out on the benchmark futures price.
Okay, so that wouldn't really be an issue in rally.
Why on Friday it just fell apart.
Okay.
Yeah, couldn't
tell. But it did.
Yeah.
Now, from a fundamental standpoint, when a market falls apart like that, do we typically see funds back away? Do they get scared, or do they look at that as a buying opportunity if it's still in an uptrend? And I know we're getting more technical here, but...
No, that's actually a really... that's a real possibility, certainly, because we haven't necessarily seen the same... It's not tied to a broader, all of a sudden, a fear about the entire economy falling apart. I think this was just sort of a one-day profit-taking scenario.
Okay.
So certainly it could be a buying opportunity for somebody. But for a farmer who is owning cotton and looking for a selling opportunity, I mean, your selling opportunity was a couple of days ago, but it still might be here.
Okay. And really, we're still 75 and change is where we closed on Friday. You know, that's almost $10 higher than where we were 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't look a gift horse in the mouth, maybe.
I was just going to say, this is a gift. Yep.
All right. So now we've got to turn to the other markets. We've got a series of questions from our Twitter followers and Facebook friends, and we appreciate all of those. I want to turn first to Rodney up in Edgar, Wisconsin. Rodney's asking, which outlook is better in both fat and feeders? Is the short-term better or the long-term outlook better?
Well, I want to say, for the feeders, I want to say the long-term, because, you know, the process of getting the profits distributed through the industry is going to take some time. I think the cow-calf operators do have the power here. I mean, they are the ones still at the very start of the chain. Whatever limited supply that we have, they're the ones who are going to have the power to negotiate any new sales to the feedlots. So I'm going to say the longer term. It's going to take some time.
Okay. On the feeder side, the fed cattle maybe look a little bit better in the short term.
Yeah, if I was right about the idea that, there's certainly profits being made. The packers are making profits. So I think that there are certainly opportunities that those markets should catch up urgently. I mean, they've been behind even the pork cutout retail-wise. You know, beef... So I guess that's not specifically a live cattle argument. I mean, it takes a couple steps to get from here to there. But yeah, I think that that's a more urgent correction that needs to be made price ratio-wise.
Okay, and hopefully we'll continue to see lighter weight cattle. We'll continue to see this market stay current. Do you have any concerns in your contacts out in cattle feeding country that we might go back to aggressively adding weight to these animals? Or do you think we're going to try to stay current at these price levels?
I don't know. And maybe, the corn price rally, the feed price rally hasn't been extreme, but it might put the brakes on some of the temptation to do that. So we might still coast along here. Yeah.
All right. So now you touched on something interesting. You talked about the demand, looking at the U.S., the demand for beef just isn't as quite as strong as we would have hoped it would be.
The
given
willingness to pay. I don't know about demand-wise, but the prices,
Okay, prices haven't climbed as we'd hoped they would, given the other factors involved. One of the components of that, on a global scale, of course, is what's happening in the rest of the world. So as we go to our next couple of questions, we take a bend to policy. Now, Elaine Kupp, in your mind, is policy a fundamental factor that affects markets?
Yes and no, right? I remember, I don't know, a decade ago or something, China made a policy that their farmers couldn't sell wheat to Mongolia. I don't know.
Sure.
I mean, this is an example. Policy says you can't do this. Mm-hmm. And yet people were putting bags of wheat on their back and walking across the border. I mean, markets will always find a way. They'll always find a way to get where people want to buy the stuff.
Sure.
But it can certainly bring challenges, and it can certainly spook prices. I mean, we saw that. I talked about that in the show with the Malaysian palm oil. There you have a government raising an export tax, being more trade protectionist, and all of a sudden, you really do have a response in prices. So yes, absolutely, it can make prices more volatile. It can absolutely change things. It probably doesn't ultimately change global supply and demand of a crop, but it can
change the sources.
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
Totally.
So trade protections. We've got a question here from Brian in Storm Lake, Iowa. He's asking, how will the Trump administration's policies impact agriculture on the corn, soybeans, and beef side of things? And before we get to that, our next question from Nathan in Cumberland, Wisconsin, is asking, what's the Mexico scuffle going to do for corn prices? The Mexican senator came out and said he's going to write a bill. I don't think as of Friday it had been proposed yet, that they were going to source corn from South America.
Yeah, and Paul did a great piece at the top of your show, if folks haven't listened to it. That was really well laid out. Both of those questions are talking about what will they do, right? And I am not going to sit here and look in a crystal ball and try and predict what a sort of unstable, temperamental person may or may not do. I'm not going to do that. But here's what I will say is that it is already affecting the market. The ship has already sailed. You know, free market-loving ag economists spent the past administration, you know, wringing our hands about how more regulation in businesses makes businesses uncertain and it makes them less likely to take on new projects, and that's bad for economic growth. Well, we are already seeing that in our ag trade. Uncertainty is bad. It makes people look around and try and gain some certainty, and that's already happening. We have Brazilian grain companies that are actively pursuing customers in Mexico. We have the Mexican Ag Secretary actively planning within the next 3 weeks to do a trade mission down to Brazil and Argentina. So we had this have, and we will still have, a beautiful logistics scenario for U.S. corn to go to Mexico. A couple of bucks on the rail, even down the river, you're there. And that will still be the case. I mean, it's not going to suddenly get shut off. That we know of. But nevertheless, already the customers that were just a captive audience for us, they're searching around. And so we're probably going to lose market share out of this, even if nothing ever happens, just because we've antagonized our closest neighbor, this great $2.5 billion corn customer per year. Yeah. Just from an antagonistic relationship, the damage has already been done.
And so once damage like this starts to be done, once they start importing, you know, just a couple of trial boats from Brazil.
Right. Yeah, we're not talking about changing the major pattern, but yeah.
We see some cancellations in orders. We see that spill out. We see prices begin to trend down. So now here's the question. I'm a producer. I'm in Iowa. I see these things happening in D.C. I hear about these things happening in Mexico City, D.F. I want to know, how do I manage that risk that I have no control over?
Oh.
What do I do? How do I continue to produce a crop?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think the people that are most concerned right now are the grain companies themselves, who are trying to put some plan Bs in place so that if they wake up one morning and a law has changed in Mexico, that they'll be able to scramble and get something changed.
Okay.
Farmers, I don't know that there's anything they can do, and I don't know that there's anything they need to do, because where it will come back to us is through basis, right? If it got shut off tomorrow, we would lose a very important direction for our corn to go. The global supply and demand of feed grains would still be the same. It would just be going in different directions. We would just lose one source of competition in the United States, and it would change the basis, particularly in the southern United States. What a farmer can do about that is, you know, I guess you could write a year's worth of basis contracts with your elevator, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
I mean, basically nothing.
Okay. All right.
Sorry.
Keep an eye on the situation and be nimble.
Yeah.
So when things are turning, as things come out of Washington, D.C., as they come out of Mexico City, you can act on them,
yeah.
I suppose.
You can write your senator, write your congressman,
right.
And cultivate local competition, local sources,
yes.
Local demand.
Local
for
demand,
your yep.
Right. That's key. We see that up in North and South Dakota when
yeah.
These trains get shut down by the snow.
Boy, yeah.
Basis takes a hit.
Absolutely.
So we've got a lot of uncertainty in the ag world today. Our next question is from Gary. He's on Twitter at Gary_Hare. He wants to know, what's the outlook for farmland values and trends in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well,
does this uncertainty carry through onto the farm level?
Probably, but not in the way. So the outlook would be interest rates are probably going to rise.
Yeah.
So that's negative. Profits are not going to be what they were in the mid-2010s. So that's negative. You do have a feedback loop from farmers who are making less money now than they were a few years ago. They can negotiate rents. They can be less willing to buy that land at auctions. But they're going to still be bidding against outside investors, and those are the people who this uncertainty, they probably are more likely to be steered toward land as a you know, as something that's real, that's probably something that they would see as favorable in their portfolios as real estate.
So even as farmer buyers maybe step back from the land market, we could see that investor level take up a bigger share and maybe not see prices change all that much.
I think that's a possibility.
All right.
But I would like to see certainly rents come down.
Yeah.
Are
they?
Yeah, I think costs have come down because that's one of the few places where the farmer really has an opportunity to change it from one year to the next. We've seen fertilizer prices come down this year compared to last year. So I think everybody's feeling a little more optimistic about their profit scenario in 2017 than they were a year ago at this time.
You know, speaking of optimistic about profit scenarios, this is the time of the year where we are calculating spring
yes.
price, Elaine Cub. Where do we sit right now?
Yeah, so February, they take an average of all the trading closes in the month of February. So far, the December corn contract average is $3.97, and the November soybean average is $10.22.
So we're probably $2 higher than last year's number in soybeans?
Yeah, wow.
$1.70?
Yeah, soybeans is nice. Like you
yeah.
said, like you can make money at that for sure. And price ratio-wise, that's the 2.6 to 1, which is historically quite favorable to soybeans, obviously.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to sell that spread? That 2.61 spread, sell the beans, buy the corn.
I would have a year ago, but it's been this way for so long. I don't know. And you look at the relative stocks, the relative mm-hmm. inventories of those two markets, and that's everything that's going on with global oil seeds, not just soybeans, but all the other global oil seeds, it may continue longer. I mean, if you're willing to sit on that spread trade for the next 5 years,
oh, wow.
eventually it will absolutely have to snap back, but I don't know how long it will take.
Okay. Elaine Cub, final question. Before we let you go, we talked a lot in this program or on the show about the large-scale investors that have made purchases here in the commodity complex, and we call them fund buyers. What are fund buyers? That's our commodity question of the week.
Yeah, so where this comes from is you have to categorize, well, you don't have to, but the CFTC does every week release a report that categorizes who has been buying and selling and what positions they have, and they have bona fide hedgers, which is any sort of farmer, processor, merchant.
Somebody who's going to touch
yes,
the grain.
Somebody
at
who
one point.
Yeah, needs to actually hedge a physical position in the market. And then they have swap dealers, which are probably banks that are doing this as a hedge for someone else's position. And then sort of anybody else that doesn't have any physical need in the market, who's just doing this as a speculation, who's doing this, who wants to take on the risk. So mm-hmm. bona fide hedgers use the futures markets to offlay their risk in the cash market, and funds and speculators take on that risk because they see it as an opportunity to make money down the road. So who are they? It could be anybody. It could be a retail investor. I mean, it could be just a guy on the street who just wants to dabble in some commodity futures and options trading. Mm-hmm. Technically, on the CFTC report, he would probably be included in the fund buying category.
Okay.
But I suppose, you know, meaning-wise, if an analyst is writing about this, when we say fund buyers, we're probably talking about hedge funds, because the index funds, that's another category. Index funds are typically just long only, and they're
yes.
not really motivated from day to day to move in and out of the markets. The fund buyers that we think of are hedge funds that are either running algorithmic trading, so they've got a mathematical calculation to go long or short in commodity futures, or they're like as a human being sitting at a desk in Chicago with a discretionary ability to decide, I think corn prices are going to go up. I'm going to put some of my money that my investors have given me to make them money, I'm going to put that into corn futures.
Okay. It's people with pools of money who are kind of disinterested. They are disinterested in the physical aspect of the trade. They're just looking for a return.
They're looking for, exactly.
All right. Well, Elaine Cubb, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this week.
It has been my pleasure.
Ours as well. And we ask all of you to join us next week when Mark Gold joins me here at the Market to Market table. And we'll explore how a key ingredient in a growing market is hard to price. So until then, thanks for watching. I'm Mike Pearson. Have a great week. And if you find value in our work, please consider clicking the Donate Now button on our website. So until then, thanks for watching or listening. I'm Mike Pearson. Now, have a great week.